All right. Welcome to the deep dive, everybody. You know, personal jurisdiction.
Oh, yeah.
It's a big one.
Huge.
It really is. Especially, you know, as the world's getting more and more interconnected. When can a court in, like, let's say California, force someone who lives in another state to show up in their courtroom?
Yeah.
It's a question that comes up all the time. And today we're going to dive deep into a Supreme Court case that really digs into all this. Culco v. Superior Court of California. Decided back in 1978, it's especially relevant in the world of family law.
Yeah, especially, you know, for all of you future lawyers out there, you're going to come across Culco. It's kind of a staple. I mean, it's a classic case that shows how that minimum contacts idea, you know, that thing we keep hearing about in civil procedure actually works when you're dealing with, like, family stuff and due process rights.
Yeah, and that's exactly why we're doing this deep dive. We're going to break down the facts of Culco. Really try to understand what the Supreme Court was thinking and talk about how this decision still shapes the way courts look at family law cases that cross state lines.
Absolutely.
So to set the stage, we have Ezra Culco and Sharon Culco Horn. They got married in 1959 in California. But here's the thing. Ezra was just passing through California on his way to Korea for military service. Their actual home, you know, their domicile, was in New York.
Yeah, so right away you can see that where they got married isn't really the main point. The big question is where they actually built their lives together as a family.
Right. So they ended up having two kids in New York in the early 60s. And they stayed there as a family until 1972 when they split up. Sharon moved to California after the separation.
Yeah, and then things got really interesting with the separation agreement. You know, they hammered out the details in New York in September of 72. The agreement said that the kids would mainly live with Ezra in New York when school was in session, but they'd spend their vacations with Sharon in California. And Ezra was on the hook for $3,000 a year in child support.
Right, specifically for those vacation periods when the kids were with Sharon.
Exactly. So, you know, to make it all official, Sharon got a divorce in Haiti. And that divorce decree, it actually included the terms of that New York separation agreement they made. So we've got, like, a legal setup already in place from New York, and it's been, you know, officially recognized through this international divorce. But then a couple of years later, things shifted in a big way.
They did. In December 73, their daughter decided she really wanted to live with Sharon in California. Ezra didn't fight it. In fact, he even bought her a one-way plane ticket to make the move happen.
Wow.
And then in January 76, their son followed suit. He also went to live with Sharon in California.
So by 76, both kids were living with Sharon in California full time. And you know what happened next? Sharon filed a lawsuit in California. She wanted the California courts to say that the Haitian divorce was legit in California. She wanted full custody of the kids. And oh yeah, she wanted Ezra to pay more child support.
Makes sense.
It does.
So Ezra, who is still living in New York, all of a sudden finds himself being sued in California.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he's like, wait a minute. Does California even have the power to make me come to court there?
Yeah, classic jurisdictional challenge, right?
Exactly. He argued that his ties to California just weren't strong enough for them to have jurisdiction over him.
Right. So this becomes a real turning point in the case. Ezra filed a motion to basically say, California, you can't serve me with these papers. You don't have authority over me in this case. But the California trial court was like, nope, sorry, we do have jurisdiction. And then both the California Court of Appeal and the California Supreme Court agreed. So as far as California was concerned, the case could move forward.
But Ezra didn't give up. He took his case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they agreed to hear it. And here's the real heart of the legal issue. Did Ezra, just by letting his daughter move to California, create enough of a connection? Those minimum contacts we always hear about for California to have jurisdiction over him when it came to child support?
Right. And there's another layer to it. Did the fact that Ezra might have saved some money by having the kids live with Sharon part of the year, was that enough to give California jurisdiction?
Those were some tough questions for the Supreme Court to grapple with. Let's break it down a bit. You know, how did the California courts try to justify their side of things?
Okay. So California really leaned on the idea of purposeful availment. Their point was that by sending his daughter to live permanently in California, you know, buying her that one-way ticket and all Ezra was choosing to benefit from California's laws, they saw it as him actively engaging with the state.
Right. Purposeful availment. It basically means you're intentionally reaching out to a state using its laws or services. So you should reasonably expect to be subject to their courts.
Exactly. And California didn't stop there. They also brought up the financial benefit angle. Their thinking was that by having his daughter in California during the school year, Ezra didn't have to fully support her during that time, and that, they argued, was a financial advantage for him, another link to California.
So they're saying he was benefiting from California in more ways than one.
Right. Plus, there's the policy argument. Every state has a huge interest in making sure kids within their borders are taken care of. So California said, look, we need to be able to make sure this kid is supported, and that means we have jurisdiction over Ezra.
So from California's point of view, it seemed like they had some pretty solid reasons for their position. But the Supreme Court didn't buy it. They actually overturned the California court's decisions. What was the main thrust of their counterargument?
Well, the Supreme Court really dug into the minimum contacts test, you know, the one that comes from the famous Case International Shoe Cove v. Washington. The court emphasized that for a state to have jurisdiction over someone who doesn't live there, the defendant's own actions have to create that connection, not just the actions of someone else.
So it's not enough that someone else, like his daughter in this case, moved to California. Ezra had to have done something himself to create that connection with the state.
Right. And this is where the whole passive versus purposeful thing comes in. The Supreme Court said that when Ezra agreed to his daughter's move and helped her with the ticket, he was basically just going along with what she wanted. It wasn't like he was actively reaching out to California and trying to use their laws or services.
I see. So the court is making a big distinction between simply agreeing to something and taking concrete steps to actually engage with California's legal system or its benefits.
Exactly. They pointed out that Ezra didn't have any strong ongoing ties to California. He didn't own property there, didn't do business there. He wasn't purposely doing things directed at the state.
So just because his daughter was living there, it didn't automatically mean California could make him come to court there.
Right. The court was worried about fairness. Can you really drag someone across state lines to face a lawsuit based on such a thin connection? And on top of that, the Supreme Court pointed out that there was a better way to handle these interstate support issues, the Uniform Reciprocal Enforcement of Support Act. It's usually called URESA for short.
Oh, right. I remember URESA.
Yeah. So this law lets a parent who needs child support to file a case in their own state, and then that state can ask the other parent's state to enforce the support order. It's like a system for working together across state lines.
That makes a lot of sense. There are already established procedures in place for exactly this kind of situation. It's not like there was no other way for Sharon to get child support from Ezra.
Exactly. But, you know, it's important to remember that the Supreme Court wasn't totally united on this. There were dissenting opinions.
Right. Not everyone on the court agreed. What were some of the concerns from the justices who disagreed with the majority?
Well, they were worried about what this ruling might mean for family law in general. Like, would it make it harder for parents to cooperate after a divorce or separation, especially when it came to kids moving between states? You know, if a parent knows they might get dragged into court in another state just because they agreed to let their kid move there, they might be less likely to go along with it in the first place.
So it could potentially discourage parents from being flexible and working together.
Right. And the dissenting justices also thought that Ezra's decision to buy that plane ticket, to them, that was a more active step than the majority gave him credit for. It wasn't just passively saying, okay, fine. It was something he did that had clear consequences in California.
So they're saying he was more involved in the situation than the majority opinion suggests.
Exactly. They believed that Ezra's actions were enough to justify California's jurisdiction.
Okay, so after all that legal back and forth, what's the big takeaway from CoolCo? What's the rule or test that we should understand about jurisdiction in this specific area?
Well, CoolCo really drives home a specific understanding of personal jurisdiction, especially in family law. First, you need purposeful availment. The parent who doesn't live in the state has to have done something to show they wanted to use that state's laws or benefits. Second, even though the California court said that the financial benefit to Ezra was enough for jurisdiction, the Supreme Court disagreed.
Right. Just because Ezra saved some money by having his kids live with Sharon part of the year, that wasn't enough for California to have jurisdiction over him. He didn't take any intentional actions to connect himself with California.
Exactly. The CoolCo case is a big deal because it reaffirms how important the minimum contacts doctrine is, even in messy family law situations. States can't just reach out and grab someone from another state unless there's a real connection.
It's all about fairness and making sure someone isn't hauled into court in a state they have almost nothing to do with.
Right.
And it also reminds us about the limits on each state's power. We have this whole system of federalism in the U.S., where power is shared between the federal government and the states. And part of that means states have to respect each other's authority, especially when it comes to things like family law.
Absolutely. You can't just ignore state lines when it comes to legal disputes.
So, what are the big things that you future legal eagles should remember from the Kulco case?
Okay. Pay attention to the difference between passive and active conduct. The Supreme Court made it clear that agreeing to something isn't the same as purposely doing something that triggers another state's laws.
And don't forget about that whole financial benefit argument that California tried to make.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court shut that down. They said that just because someone might save some money doesn't mean a state can claim jurisdiction over them. It all goes back to those purposeful contacts with the state.
Right.
And remember, each state has its own limits. There are systems in place, like ERISA, to handle these issues that cross state lines. Kulco is a good example of how those boundaries work in practice.
It is.
Well, as we wrap up this deep dive into Kulco v. Superior Court, we'll leave you with one final thought. Think about how the rules established in this 1978 case still matter today, especially in our increasingly mobile world. With more and more people working remotely and families living in different states, how will technology and these new ways of living affect the way we think about personal jurisdiction? What new challenges will we face?
And if this has got you thinking about personal jurisdiction, check out the original International Shoe Case and how state long-arm statutes have changed over time. There's a whole fascinating history to explore in this area of law.
Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.